Hey Boo, we're continuing Chapter 7 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And if you remember, the three kids, Harry, Hermione, and Ron, were walking across the grounds amidst all the tents for all the people getting ready for the World Cup. So, Hermione just asked, I wonder what the Bulgarians have got dangling over their tents. Let's go and have a look, said Harry, pointing to a large patch of tents upfield, where the Bulgarian flag, white, green, and red, was fluttering in the breeze. The tents here had not been bedecked with plant life, but each and every one of them had the same poster attached to it, a poster of a very surly face with heavy black eyebrows. The picture was, of course, moving, but all it did was blink and scowl. Crumb, said Ron quietly. What? Said Hermione. Crumb, said Ron. Victor Crumb, the Bulgarian seeker. He looks really grumpy, said Hermione, looking around at the many crumbs blinking and scowling at them. Really grumpy? Ron raised his eyes to the heavens. Who cares what he looks like? He's unbelievable. He's really young, too. Only just 18 or something. He's a genius. You wait until tonight, you'll see. There is already a small queue for the tap in the corner of the field. Harry, Ron, and Hermione joined it, right behind a pair of men who were having a very heated argument. One of them was a very old wizard who was wearing a long, flowery nightgown. The other was clearly a ministry wizard. He was holding out a pair of pinstriped trousers and almost crying with exasperation. Just put them on, Archie. There's a good chap. You can't walk around like that. The muggle at the gate's already getting suspicious. I bought this in a muggle shop, said the old wizard stubbornly. Muggles wear them. Muggle women wear them, Archie, not the men. They wear these, said the ministry wizard. He brandished the pinstriped trousers. I'm not putting them on, said old Archie in indignation. I like a healthy breeze round my privates, thanks. Hermione was overcome with such a strong fit of the giggles at this point that she had to duck out of the queue and only returned when Archie had collected his water and moved away. Walking more slowly now because of the weight of the water, they made their way back across the campsite. Here and there they saw more familiar faces, other Hogwarts students with their families. Oliver Wood, the captain of Harry's house Quidditch team, who had just left Hogwarts, dragged Harry over to his parents' tent to introduce him. And they told him excitedly that he had just been signed to the Puddlemore United reserve team. Next, they were hailed by Ernie McMillan, a Hufflepuff fourth year. And a little farther on, they saw Cho Chang, a very pretty girl, who played Seeker on the Ravenclaw team. She waved and smiled at Harry, who slopped quite a lot of water down his front as he waved back. More to stop Ron from smirking than anything, Harry hurriedly pointed out a large group of teenagers whom he'd never seen before. Who do you reckon they are? He said. They don't go to Hogwarts, do they? Expect they go to some foreign school, said Ron. I know there are others. Never met anyone who went to one, though. Bill had a pen friend in a school in Brazil. This was years and years ago. And he wanted to go on an exchange trip, but Mom and Dad couldn't afford it. His pen friend got all offended when he said he wasn't going and sent him a cursed hat and made his ears shrivel up. Harry laughed, but didn't voice the amazement he felt at hearing about other wizarding schools. He supposed, not that he saw representatives of so many nationalities in the campsite, that he had been too stupid never to realize that Hogwarts couldn't be the only one. He glanced at Hermione, who looked utterly unsurprised by the information. No doubt she had run across the news about other wizarding schools in some book or other. You know, it makes you wonder why, I guess it's a coincidence or not, that like, all of the main good guys and bad guys all come from Hogwarts. Like, I guess it's a coincidence because Voldemort was there, but also Dumbledore and all, you know, all these guys. Why are they so good there? You've been ages, said George when they finally got back to the Weasleys' tents. Met a few people, said Ron, setting the water down. You got that fire started yet? Dad's having fun with the matches, said Fred. Mr. Weasley was having no success at all in lighting the fire, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Splintered matches littered the ground around him, but he looked as though he was having the time of his life. Oops, he said, as he managed to light a match and promptly dropped it in surprise. Come here, Mr. Weasley, said Hermione kindly, taking the box from him and showing him how to do it properly. And so at last they got the fire lit, though it was at least another hour before it was hot enough to cook anything. There was plenty to watch while they waited, however. Their tent seemed to be pitched right alongside a kind of thoroughfare to the field, and ministry members kept hurrying up and down it, greeting Mr. Weasley cordially as they passed. Mr. Weasley kept up the running commentary, mainly for Harry and Hermione's benefit. His own children knew too much about the ministry to be greatly interested. That was Cuthbert Mockridge, head of the Goblin Liaison Office. Here comes Gilbert Wimple. He's with the Committee on Experimental Charms. He's had those horns for a while now. Hello, Arnie. Arnold Peasgoose. He's an Obliviator. Member of the Accidental Magic Reversal Squad, you know. And that's Bode and Croker. They're Unspeakables. They're what? From the Department of Mysteries. Top secret. No idea what they get up to. At last, the fire was ready, and they had just started cooking eggs and sausages when Bill, Charlie, and Percy came strolling out of the woods towards them. Just apparated, Dad, said Percy loudly. Ah, excellent lunch. They were halfway through their plate of eggs and sausages when Mr. Weasley jumped to his feet, waving and grinning at a man who was striding toward them. Aha, he said, the man of the moment, Ludo. Ludo Bagman was easily the most noticeable person Harry had seen so far, including old Archie in his flowered nightdress. He was wearing long quidditch robes and thick horizontal stripes of black and yellow. An enormous picture of a wasp was splashed across his chest. He had the look of a powerfully built man, gone slightly to seed. The robes were stretched tightly across a large belly he surely had not had in the days when he had played Quidditch for England. His nose was squashed, probably broken by a stray bludger, Harry thought. But his round blue eyes, short blonde hair, and rosy complexion made him look like a very overgrown schoolboy. Ahoy there! Bagman called happily. He was walking as though he had springs attached to the balls of his feet, and he was plainly in a state of wild excitement. Arthur, old man! He puffed as he reached the campfire. What a day, eh? What a day! Couldn't we have asked for better weather? Cloudless night coming, and hardly a hiccup of arrangements. Not much for me to do. Behind him, a group of haggard-looking ministry wizards rushed past, pointing at the distant evidence of some sort of magical fire that was sending violet sparks 20 feet into the air. Percy hurried forward with his hands outstretched. Apparently his disapproval of the way Ludo Bagman ran his department did not prevent him from wanting to make a good impression. Ah, yes, said Mr. Weasley, grinning. This is my son Percy. He's just started at the ministry. And this is Fred. No, George. Sorry, that's Fred. Bill, Charlie, Ron, my daughter Ginny, Ron's friends Hermione Granger and Harry Potter. Bagman did the smallest of double takes when he heard Harry's name, and his eyes performed the familiar flick upward to the scar on Harry's forehead. Everyone, Mr. Weasley continued, this is Ludo Bagman. You know who he is. It's thanks to him we've got such good tickets. Bagman beamed and waved his hands as if to say it was nothing. Fancy a flutter on the match, Arthur? He said eagerly, jingling what seemed to be a large amount of gold in his pockets. I've already got Roddy Pontner betting Bulgaria will score first. I've offered him nice odds, considering Ireland's front three are the strongest I've seen in years. Little Agatha Timms has put up half shares in her eel farm on a weekend-long match. Oh, go on then, said Mr. Weasley. Let's see, a galleon on Ireland to win? A galleon? Ludo Bagman looked slightly disappointed, but recovered himself. Very well, very well. Any other takers? They're a bit young to be gambling, said Mr. Weasley. Molly wouldn't rank. We'll bet 37 galleons, 15 sickles, 3 newts, said Fred, as he and George quickly pooled all their money, that Iron wins, but Victor Crumb gets the snitch. Oh, and we'll throw in a fake wand. You don't want to be showing Mr. Bagman rubbish like that, Percy hissed, but Bagman didn't seem to think the wand was rubbish at all. On the contrary, his boyish face shone with excitement as he took it from Fred. And when the wand gave a loud squawk and turned into a rubber chicken, Bagman roared with laughter. Excellent. I haven't seen one that convincing in years. I'd pay 5 galleons for that. Percy froze in an attitude of stunned disapproval. Boys, said Mr. Weasley under his breath, I don't want you betting. That's all your savings. Your mother... Don't be a spoilsport, Arthur, boomed Ludo Bagman, rattling his pockets excitedly. You're old enough to know what they want. You reckon Ireland will win, but Crum will get the snitch? Not a chance, boys, not a chance. I'll give you excellent odds to that one. We'll add 5 galleons for the funny wand, then, shall we? Mr. Weasley looked on helplessly as Ludo Bagman whipped out a notebook and quill and began jotting down the twins' names. Cheers, said George, taking the slip of parchment Bagman handed him and tucking it away in the front of his robes. Bagman turned most cheerfully back to Mr. Weasley. Couldn't do me a brew, I suppose. I'm keeping an eye out for Barty Crouch. My Bulgarian opposite number is making difficulties, and I can't understand a word he's saying. Barty will be able to sort it out. He speaks about 150 languages. Mr. Crouch, said Percy, suddenly abandoning his look of poker-stiff disapproval and positively writhing with excitement. He speaks over 200, Mermish and gobbledygook and troll. Anyone can speak troll, said Fred dismissively. All you have to do is point and grunt. Percy threw Fred an extremely nasty look and stoked the fire vigorously to bring the kettle back to a boil. Any news of Bertha Jenkins, Jorkins, yet, Ludo? Mr. Weasley asked as Bagman settled down on the grass beside them. Not a dicky bird, said Bagman comfortably, but she'll turn up. Poor old Bertha, memory like a leaked cauldron, and no sense of direction. Lost, if you take my word for it. She'll wander back into the office sometime in October, thinking it's still July. You don't think it might be time to send someone looking for her? Said Mr. Weasley tentatively, as Percy handed Bagman his tea. Barty Crouch keeps saying that, said Bagman, his round eyes widening innocently. We really can't spare anyone at the moment. Oh, talk of the devil. Barty! A wizard had just apparated at their fireside, and he could not have made more of a contrast with Ludo Bagman, sprawled on the grass in his old wasp robes. Barty Crouch was a stiff, upright, an elderly man, dressed in impeccably crisp suit and tie. The parting of his short gray hair was almost unnaturally straight, and his narrow toothbrush mustache looked as though he had trimmed it using a slide rule. His shoes were very highly polished. Harry could see at once why Percy idolized him. Percy was a great believer in rigidly following rules. And Mr. Crouch, I know what you're thinking, Harry, and I do not like him. And Mr. Crouch had complied with the rule about muggle dressing so thoroughly he could have passed for a bank manager. Harry doubted even Uncle Vernon would have spotted him for what he really was. Pull up a bit of grass, Barty, said Ludo brightly, patting the ground behind him. No thank you, Ludo, said Crouch, and there was a bit of impatience in his voice. I've been looking for you everywhere. The Bulgarians are insisting we add another 12 seats to the top box. Oh, is that what they're after? Said Bagman. I thought the chap was asking to borrow a pair of tweezers. A bit of a strong accent. Mr. Crouch, said Percy breathlessly, sunk in a kind of half-bow that made him look like a hunchback. Would you like a cup of tea? Oh, said Mr. Crouch, looking over at Percy in mild surprise. Oh, yes, thank you, Weatherby. Fred and George choked in their own cups, Percy very pink around the ears. Busied himself with the kettle. Oh, and I've been wanting a word with you too, Arthur, said Mr. Crouch, his sharp eyes falling on Mr. Weasley. Ali Bashir's on the warpath. He wants a word with you about your embargo on flying carpet. Mr. Weasley heaved a deep sigh. I sent him an owl about that just last week. If I've told him once, I've told him 100 times. Carpets are defined as muggle artifacts by the Registry of Prescribed Charmable Objects. Will he listen? I doubt it, said Mr. Crouch, accepting a cup from Percy. He's desperate to export here. Well, they'll never replace brooms in Britain, will they? Said Bagman. Ali thinks there's a niche in the market for a family vehicle, said Mr. Crouch. I remember my father had an Axminster that could seat 12. That was before carpets were banned, of course. He spoke as though he wanted to leave nobody in any doubt that all his ancestors had strictly abided by the law. "So, been keeping busy, Barty?" said Bagman breezily. "Fairly," said Mr. Crouch dryly. "Organizing port keys across 5 continents is no mean feat, Ludo." "I expect you'll be glad when this is all over," said Mr. Weasley. Ludo Bagman looked shocked. "Glad? Don't know when I've had more fun. Still, it's not as though we haven't got anything to look forward to, eh, Barty? Eh, plenty left to organize." Mr. Crouch raised his eyebrows at Bagman. "We agreed not to make an announcement until all the details." "Oh, details," said Bagman, waving the word away like a cloud of midges. "They've signed, haven't they? They've agreed, haven't they? I'll bet you anything, these kids will know soon enough. I mean, it's happening at Hogwarts." "Ludo, we need to meet the Bulgarians, you know," said Mr. Crouch sharply, cutting Bagman's remarks short. "Thank you for the tea, Weatherby." He pushed his undrunk tea back at Percy and waited for Ludo to rise. Bagman struggled to his feet, swigging down the last of his tea, the gold in his pockets chinking merrily. "See y'all later," he said. "You'll be up in the top box with me. I'm commentating. He waved. Barty Crouch nodded curtly, and both of them disapparated. "What's happening at Hogwarts, Dad?" said Fred at once. "What were they talking about?" "You'll find out soon enough," said Mr. Weasley, smiling. "It's classified information until such time as Ministry decides to release it," said Percy stiffly. "Mr. Crouch was quite right not to disclose it." "Oh, shut up, Weatherby," said Fred. A sense of excitement rose like a palpable cloud over the campsite as the afternoon wore on. By dusk, the still summer air itself seemed to be quivering with anticipation, and as darkness spread like a curtain over the thousands of waiting wizards, the last vestiges of pretense disappeared. The Ministry seemed to have bowed to the inevitable and stopped fighting the signs of blatant magic now breaking out everywhere. Salesmen were apparating every few feet, carrying trays and pushing carts full of extraordinary merchandise. There were luminous rosettes, green for Ireland, red for Bulgaria, which were squealing the names of players, pointed green hats beckoning with dancing shamrocks, Bulgarian scarves adorned with lions that really roared, flags from both countries that played their national anthems as they were waved. There were tiny models of firebolts that really flew, and collectible figures of famous players which strolled across the palm of your hand, preening themselves. "Been saving my pocket money for this," Ron told Harry as they and Hermione strolled through the salesman buying souvenirs. Though Ron purchased a dancing shamrock hat and a large green rosette, he also bought a small figure of Victor Crumb, the Bulgarian seeker. The miniature Crumb walked backward and forward over Ron's hand, scowling at the green rosette above him. "Wow, look at these," said Harry, hurrying over to a cart piled high with what looked like brass binoculars, except that they were covered with all sorts of weird knobs and dials. "Omnioculars," said the salesman eagerly. "You can replay action, slow everything down, and they flash up play-by-play breakdown if you need it. Bargain, 10 gallons each." "Wish I hadn't bought this now," said Ron, gesturing at his dancing shamrock and gazing longingly at the omnioculars. "3 pairs, said Harry firmly to the wizard. "No, don't bother," said Ron, going red. He was always touchy about the fact that Harry, who had inherited a small fortune from his parents, had much more money than he did. "You won't be getting anything for Christmas," Harry told him, thrusting omnioculars into his hands. "For about 10 years, mind." "Fair enough," said Ron, grinning. "Oh, thanks, Harry," said Hermione. "And I'll get us some programs, look." Their money bags considerably lighter, they went back to their tents. Bill, Charlie, and Ginny were all sporting green rosettes, too, and Mr. Weasley was carrying an Irish flag. Fred and George had no souvenirs, as they had given Bagman all their gold. And then a deep, booming gong sounded somewhere beyond the woods, and at once green and red lanterns blazed to life in the trees, lighting a path to the field. "It's time," said Mr. Weasley, looking as excited as any of them. "Come on, let's go." And that's the end of Chapter 7. And next we'll read Chapter 8, called The Quidditch World Cup. I hope you like that, my sweet lover. I miss you so much already. I can't wait to see you again in a few days. You're the sweetest girl ever, and I love you so very much. Sleep well, boo. Good night.